Steve Cohen may be worth about $5.5 billion. His hedge fund, SAC Capital, is said to have accounted in the past for as much as 3% of all stock traded in the New York Stock Exchange, and he may be something of a legend on Wall Street, but chances are, until fairly recently, you hadn't heard much about him. Joining me now to explain who Steve Cohen is and why he's gotten so much bad publicity recently is Vanity Fair's special correspondent Brian Burrow. His article, What's Eating Steve Cohen, appears in the July issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Burrow back to our show today. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Larry.
Steve Cohen has shunned the spotlight and has only granted one other published interview in the past. How were you able to get him to agree to a profile?
Well, I'd like to think it was just my innate charm. In fact, I think it had more to do with the fact that he has been drawn into the tabloid headlines at a time where there is a lot of anger out there directed at the masters of the universe of Wall Street. And I believe they found it was in their interest to emerge from this long cone of silence and try to explain themselves.
Do you think that some of the negative press is because he doesn't do many interviews?
Certainly. I think most people would realize that if you don't engage with the press is going to tend to say what it wants. And so I think to some extent he has been the victim of his own silence.
And then there's a matter of success. Success sometimes leads to bad press, either through jealousy or, there are all sorts of reasons that we don't always like people who make a lot of money and then we don't know much about them.
Well, you're exactly right. And I think Mr. Cohen had the unfortunate decision several years ago to buy what is generally regarded as the grandest mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut, which I think brought on to him a lot more publicity and focus than many of his peers, a development that still boggles his mind.
Although it's weird to be ostentatious in that way and at the same time shun attention in other ways. I would think that if I didn't want to be noticed, I would buy a modest house, maybe fill it with the best stuff, but nobody would know.
Well, I think there's a difference between being noticed and respected by your peers and friends, and then there's being noticed by the great unwashed. And I think most of those in the hedge fund industry and Wall Street in general would rather have that.
I knew someone who worked as a personal banker to many people in Wall Street, and almost all of them had gambling problems.
Steve Cohen started not really trading stocks, but at the poker table for years and years and years, which is, as he says in the article, was really the basis of his falling in love with probability and all the things that he uses in trading stocks.
So, and at Bear Stearns, the game was bridge, wasn't it?
You're exactly right. Ace Greenberg, the longtime chairman there, was a tournament bridge player, and he met his successor, Jimmy Kane, I recall, who was a cab driver at the bridge table. So that was the game at Bear, definitely.
Well, I understand how being a cab driver, bridge will help a cab driver become the head of a major brokerage house. But
happens every day.
How did the poker work for Steve Cohen?
Well, I think playing cards successfully is not all that different from playing stocks in that you're assessing the probability of any number of things to happen. It's essentially a mathematical game. It's a mathematical.
So 21 would have worked just as well?
Sure. It was just that this is what he and his pals in ninth grade in Great Neck decided to start playing, and Steve was very, very good at it.
And he started off in arbitrage and Grentel and Company. Was he good at it?
He didn't stay at it long enough to find out if he was good at it, because that type of arbitrage was basically involved hedging a single stock bet so many ways that there was no risk. And he wanted that feel of poker, that feel of gambling, that feel of really betting on a stock.
So he got them to switch him over to trading?
Exactly. And he did quite well with it. He was an overnight star, and this was circa 1980.
How did he develop his style of trading? Did he use an algorithm, or is it intuitive to him?
It's funny. If you talk about a lot of traders, it's hard to pin that down. With him, it's very, very specific. He is what a certain generation of Wall Street or an older generation would know as a tape reader. He first became obsessed with stocks. I think really watching stock symbols the green symbols tick, 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 tick across a Merrill Lynch office in downtown Philadelphia while he was in college. And he found that for whatever reason, he says it has to do with probability, he became pretty good with guessing which way those numbers were going to go. So that early on, his early success in the early 80s was almost, he says it had nothing to do with the stock. He didn't care what the stock made. He often didn't know what the company made. He just had a feel for the numbers.
He relied on patterns?
Yes. He says it's a pattern recognition thing for him. In the article, I compare it to a scene in that great movie, A Beautiful Mind, where Russell Crowe's character stares at a great bank of numbers and then suddenly some of them begin flashing, and it's pattern recognition.
Well, there are other people who are good at math. Is he the only one who's really done this very well?
He's certainly not the only one. However, I think any poll of the greatest tape readers of Wall Street in the last half century would place him number one or number two.
I'm talking to Brian Burrow, whose latest article in Vanity Fair is called What's Eating Steve Cohn? It's in the July issue of the magazine. When did he leave Gruntle to start SAC?
He felt he had pretty much run the table at Gruntle in about 1990 or 1991. I believe he actually finally went out on his own in 92. It was purely a question of Gruntle wouldn't advance him any more money, and he wanted more.
Mm-hmm. So he felt like he'd hit a ceiling there?
Yes. I believe his ceiling was something in the order of $50 million, and at that point he was ready for the big time.
And he was starting a hedge fund at a time when they were pretty new, weren't they?
Well, hedge funds themselves were not new in that the concept goes back to the late 40s, or some would argue even longer. But there was, after the crash of the late 80s and M&A kind of going downhill, there was a flight of top money managers out to found their own shops in the early 90s. And Cohen was very much in the vanguard of those people. And they ended up calling these things hedge funds.
Was he doing something very different from what he had done at Gruntle?
No, he did the exact same thing in the exact same building. But instead of personally taking 60% of his profit, he got 50% at a hedge fund.
And he uses very fast trading methods. Some people have even put him down as a glorified day trader.
Well, my word, but I think that's fair. It's one of the reasons he got so little respect for so long was because he did his style is was reading that tape, augmented, of course, in later years by analysis and learning about companies. But he would hop in and out of hundreds, if not thousands, of trades in a day.
Well, he can't do that all by himself. How do you teach that to employees?
Well, he did a lot of it himself. And as he grew and could not do it all himself, he began bringing in all sorts of young, brilliant types that he called portfolio managers. And SAC success has been built by their success as well. And it's not a question of Cohen teaching them so much as giving them a chunk of money saying, here, now if you don't make 30% this year, you're out. It's that type of pressure.
Isn't jumping in and out of stocks unusual for a hedge fund?
Oh, I don't think it's unusual. There's every type of hedge fund, just like there's every type of doctor and lawyer and journalist. I don't find his strategy particularly unusual. I guess what was unusual is that, you know, he paid at one point in the late 90s, because he was paying commissions on every one of these trades. He was something like one of the top 10 customers of the major Wall Street firms who were clearing and processing his trades.
As we said earlier, 3% of all the stock traded on the New York Stock Exchange at one point.
Yeah, that was it. That was at the height of his kind of his coming out, if you will. In the kind of 98 to 2003 time frame. These days it may still be every bit as large, but they're not so eager to disclose that.
You spent time at SAC Capital. What's the corporate culture there like? Is it dominated by Cohn's personality as much as you might think?
Yes. They will be the first to tell you and emphasize that Steve, or as the street still calls him, Stevie, which he hates, only—
They see him as a young guy still?
No, it's just Stevie? When he was coming up, he was always Stevie, and he never grew out of that. He says he just hates it. But in any case, he does dominate the culture, even though he trades only about 15% of their overall capital, about $2 billion. When I was sitting watching him, he had about $2 billion in positions in front of him. But, you know, he takes the best trades that all his PMs are doing, takes their ideas. Every Sunday night, there's a big, you know, a meeting where everybody gives him their ideas for the week. He even has what they call the Steve Cam, which is a camera mounted over his desk so that everybody in the firm, should they wish, can watch him and know exactly what he's doing at any given moment. It is, I don't want to say idol culture, but he personifies that place the way Steve Jobs does Apple.
But he also has cameras on every trader's desk, doesn't he?
I assume he does. I don't know that for a fact.
Well, that must make you feel like there's something slightly totalitarian about the place.
I think, or
is it egalitarian?
I think he would tell you that it's proudly totalitarian.
He also keeps the office cold.
Yeah, he has this thing where he thinks that traders should stay alert, and apparently read some study that says 68 is the ideal temperature to keep everyone alert. And because Cohen is so closely followed by the rest of the street, I did kind of put a big bulletin in this article that alert, he's now moved it up to 70 degrees because it's better for his aching back.
In 1998 and 99, SAC Capital posted 70% annual returns. That sounds like Bernie Madoff numbers.
Well, you're exactly right. He did it, from all appearances, entirely legitimately by riding every tech stock that you could ride in those raucous years. But it did raise those types of questions across Wall Street. And these are rumors that have plagued him to this day, that SAC was doing something it shouldn't. Well, exactly what? No one could say, but that he was so good it couldn't be legitimate.
Well, and he also has been connected to people who have been caught doing things that weren't always legitimate.
You can say that. You know, he's had some former employees that have been caught up in the Galleon scandal. I'm not sure that really is fair to say that he's been caught up in the Galleon scandal. But, you know, it's the type of thing that for years they openly acknowledge and would try to convince people, hey, we're not insider tradings. We're not traders. We're not front running. We're doing what you're supposed to do very well.
Why wasn't he hurt when the tech bubble burst in 2000?
In the tech bubble.
Well, you said he rode that tech bubble.
He did. And in 2000, he went short tech stocks. That is, he bet against them in advance of the break in that market in April 2000. And he posted another 70% return by riding those stocks all the way down. And that really was the creation of his legend. Until that point, I think Steve Cohen was known on Wall Street, but not beyond.
Well, you said that he saw patterns. What was he seeing that other people weren't seeing at that time?
I can't tell. We didn't drill down into that discussion of that decision enough for me to inform you, Leonard. But clearly, he felt like the valuations had just gone too high.
At one point, didn't he consider taking SAC public?
Oh, several times I think he did. And it was kind of at the height of what people now view as the silliness of 2006, 2007, right before the housing bubble burst, that investment bankers came to SEC and said that they would place a value of as much as $20 billion on SAC. And, you know, he thought they were nuts. On the other hand, he wasn't going to walk away from that much money. So he looked at it and was still looking at it at the time that the housing bubble burst, and then he discarded that idea.
Also, if you go public, you have to make all your methods known better, don't you? It's hard to remain as secretive as he is.
You're exactly right. And when he canvassed Wall Street CEOs to see about pros and cons, he did not like what he heard in terms of the cons. And that was clearly the transparency that a public company has to engage in. And a hedge fund just, by and large, doesn't want to do that.
Brian Barrow is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair. His article, What's Eating Steve Cohen, appears in the July issue. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Brian Barrow, a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, whose latest article is What's Eating Steve Cohen. It appears in the July issue. This is kind of like What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
I gather that was the illusion there, yes.
Because, you didn't write the title?
No. In fact, that's one of my defensibles is when bullets start to fly after publication, I inevitably am able to claim that I didn't write the headlines or the captions.
Well, what is eating him? Is something eating him?
Well, many things. First and foremost, his back, which causes him so much pain. He's given some some thought to retirement, which is, I think, prompted some headlines as a result of this story.
But bad back because he's hunched over a computer all the time?
Well, because he spent 33 years sitting in chairs like you and I are. But I think more broadly, he is for the first time dealing with a serious amount of bad press, everything from his ex-wife suing him to a rabbi from Brooklyn allegedly trying to extort money from him to this ongoing Galleon scandal in which people seem to think he should be involved. And all that is just really gotten under his skin.
Well, let's talk about some of those things. His wife sued him for $300 million. That's a serious divorce.
Well, that's a lot of money to you and me, but when you're worth as much as he is, it's, you know, just something that's a major irritant.
Does he admit to being worth $5.5 billion?
It's not something that one discusses when one goes into these homes, Leonard. So, no, I didn't ask that question. He and the ex-wife actually have been divorced for about 20 years, and she's done quite well, but she alleges that there was more money at the time of the divorce that she didn't know about, so she's worth a little bit more.
How did that lawsuit end up bringing up questions about the ethics surrounding the takeover of RCA General by General Electric in the mid-1980s?
Well, she essentially threw a big bucket of dirt out there for the press to look through. And one of the things that she came up with was that he had been interviewed or the target of a subpoena in an insider trading investigation way back in 1985. Nothing ever happened. But it was, of course, quite embarrassing to Cohen when this came out over the winter.
Well, he took the Fifth Amendment
right
when he was interviewed by the SEC for a deposition.
Yeah.
How did he react when you brought that up?
He didn't want to talk about the ex-wife. That was actually the single thing that he said the lawyers just won't let me talk about it. And given how many other things he would talk about, I didn't complain.
You mentioned the reports that Brooklyn Rabbi Milton Balcony was trying to extort $4 million from him because he had evidence of insider training at SAC. How did the rabbi get that, claim he got that information?
As I recall, the rabbi had some type of social work at a prison, and a prisoner, he alleged, said, you know, told him this. It actually, for all the headlines that it generated, the SAC people describe it as, you know, apparently just three or four phone calls to their general counsel who handed it off to a Brooklyn district attorney and it went away. But it was another one of those things where it seemed like for about the last 6 or 8 months, practically the only hedge funder that you were reading about in the general press was Steve Cohen over and over and over.
Well, he's been investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission several times, more than Bernie Madoff was.
I don't know that to be true. I know that even his people would acknowledge that in this Galleon scandal, I think he is generally seen as the unofficial ultimate target because of the rumors and things that have plagued him all the years. I'm far from convinced that any case will ever be made.
Reading the figures is very important to his methods, but isn't information very important to the way he trades as well? And information is where you get into that slippery slope over insider trading.
You're exactly right. And, you know, these questions about SAC have go back 15 years. And Cohen talked a lot about that. And I think what I came out feeling is that back in the 90s when he was making his bones and before a number of SEC regulations were passed that really began to confine the flow of non-public information, I think SEC played pretty loose with information flow, as did many of its peers. I think that as the rules have tightened, I think, frankly, he's too smart to do anything that big and stupid these days.
But if the money is made when you get information before anyone else gets it, whether it's hard information or gossip, doesn't that make it harder to avoid doing insider trades?
Well, insider information is not a science, it's an art as far as defining what it is. If I tell you I hear something, I have to be in a position to know that for that to be insider information. If I heard it eighth, in other words, it's very hard to define these cases. It's very hard to bring them.
So if you, as a correspondent for Vanity Fair, tell me, you know, just speaking to Steve Cohen and blah, 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 and I then use that information to buy something or sell something, that's not insider trading.
It would depend on what I passed on. If Steve Cohen had purely hypothetically, an illegal conversation with a CEO in which he warned him of an impending takeover, then told me and I told you, you could be, the SEC could take action. If Cohen just passed on a rumor to me that I passed on to you that turned out to be true, that's probably not.
Did you talk about this with him? How does he draw the line between getting information and doing insider trades?
Well, he said, I think, what any smart trader would say at this point, and that's anytime something doesn't smell quite right, you bring in the lawyers and you do what they tell you.
But he did come close to saying that he had misused information in the past.
Well, that's my characterization, in that he, when I pressed on their procedures and practices earlier in the firm's life, he said, look, we learned a lot of things and we've tightened up our procedures. That tells me, yeah, he knows that some of the things that they did back in the day probably would not pass muster today.
In the past, people have said that SAC Capital would try to create a head fake in the market to make money. For instance, they'll have one trader start selling some stock, the rest of Wall Street notices and start selling, and then they'll swoop in and buy up a lot more stock at a depressed price. Is that unusual for a hedge fund to do?
No, I don't think it's unusual for any company that's being watched to do. I have heard the exact same stories told about NFL teams in an NFL draft and oil companies in the draft of mineral rights. To me, that's probably just smart business, unless there was some illegality that was embedded into it.
The difference is, of course, that SAC Capital is such a big player that when they start selling something, people are more likely to notice.
Oh, exactly. I think Cohen has...
And he understands that.
Yeah. Over the last 10 years, you've become aware that they are very closely watched by competitors as well as regulators. And so I think deception, at least in terms of market performance, is probably built into what they do now.
My guest is Brian Burrow, special correspondent for Vanity Fair. His article in the July issue of that magazine is called What's Eating Steve Cohen? This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How does he react to all of the anger that's been directed at him? Does he understand why people are so angry with him?
He understands why Americans are angry at Wall Street and hedge fund types. He doesn't understand why they're angry at him. He doesn't feel like he's done anything. From his point of view, he simply is a businessman running a very successful business. And he says, and I would have to agree with this, that if he were running a similarly sized mutual fund, no one would be, you know, the New York Post would never be writing about him. And he's probably right. But the fact is, at a time where many Americans are angry at Greenwich hedge funds, he does have the largest home up there. He is very big. And he also fits the profile that fascinates the New York media, which is a middle-class Long Island kid who did well. I mean, part of the reason the media has been so fascinated with him is he has so much in common with the media.
I would think something else has happened. In the past, the press has been accused of not paying enough attention, and now they're going to pay a lot of attention. And some of the similarities between how Cohen has operated in the past and what Galleon head Raj Rajaratnam,
yes,
is that his name, has been charged with. There are certain similarities.
But there are a lot of similarities between Raj's old business and the way Cohen was said to have run SEC back in the day. And a lot of people said, you know, SEC was as aggressive as anybody in bringing in non-public information, not necessarily illegal information, but that they wanted to be out there on the cutting edge. That's one of the things that has led to all this speculation that somehow SEC would be drawn into the Galleon scandal, something I've yet to be convinced will actually happen. But it certainly doesn't mean that they've done anything actionable.
Yesterday, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission issued a subpoena for Goldman Sachs in connection with its investigation. So does the rumor swirling end up becoming a problem? You know, where there's smoke, there's fire?
Well, I think that's part of the reason Cohen gave what the second public interview of his 33-year career to Vanity Fair, is that, you know, given that money is not falling off trees into hedge funds anymore, he needs to be out there raising money, and he really cannot allow his name any longer to be besmirched without having that have an effect on his impact on his business.
What about former employees? Are they likely to besmirch his name?
you know, I've talked to those who do and those who don't. Those who do basically just say, I don't like the guy because he yelled and used the F word a lot. Others will, you know, step up to the plate and say he is the most brilliant, pure stock trader of the last 50 years. So you hear everything. If you're a reporter, what you're hearing from, what you're looking for is something that smells like fire, not smoke. And I didn't get enough of that.
I was a bit confused by something that you wrote. You say, of all the CEOs and billionaires I've met over the last 25 years, Cohen comes off as the most unpretentious. But he's also become a major art collector, which is pretty much what all of those guys do when they suddenly find themselves with more money than they know how to spend.
That's part of his image problem, I think, is that this idea of, you know, Brooklyn to Greenwich in one generation, you have to have the art to match. I used unpretentious to refer to his physical, his appearance and the way he is man to man. He just comes across as any other trader. If you met him at your parents, at your cousin's wedding, you'd never guess he was the legendary Stevie Cohen. But in terms, if you want to define pretension by material wealth and certainly art, oh boy, well, that's a different thing. He's pretty pretentious.
Well, I've always wondered why, when these people reach a couple of billion dollars, why they seem to be driven to make so much more. It isn't because he wants to make the people who work for him rich. Obviously, there's some kind of self-aggrandizement there, isn't there?
Clearly. The one thing I noticed when I first came to Wall Street in the mid-1980s is how much smarter these people become once they make that first billion. Suddenly, they become experts on just about everything, not just stocks. Cohen clearly has amassed one of the greatest private art collections in the country today. And a lot of people can say it's for status, and it may be. But I think what I also picked up is he enjoys it very much because it's really the first distraction other than his family he's ever developed, something to take his mind off that market 5 or 6 days a week.
Is money a way for him and I'm sure a fair number of other people in the business of keeping score?
Well, every single one of them. I mean, in every business I've ever written about, from oil to Wall Street, will tell you money qua money does not matter. It's about measuring yourself against others who are doing the same.
Well, a lot of people have back problems. They don't consider retiring. As if you have $5.5 billion, you just go to the best back specialists and you fix the problem, or you get a better chair.
But if you have $5.5 billion, it's so much easier to say, I don't need to do this anymore.
Yeah.
I can just sit around and work on my golf game. I understand that, and I don't have $5.5 billion.
Are you a good golfer?
No.
You think he's going to quit?
No. I think they're going to have to. I think he talks like this as a way of showing evidence of how disgusted he is with, you know, the press he's received. I think that he will be dragged away from that trading desk by his feet first.
But can he improve his image? After all, people hire PR firms all the time to spin better images.
I think that's part of what this Vanity Fair article is, no doubt. I'd be silly not to acknowledge that. Of course he can improve his image in part by just attempting to mold it, which he has not done enough of in the past.
Well, do you think that he was effective in dealing with you? He's famous for his temper, but he comes across as rather mild-tempered.
Well, yes, but he's going to perform at his best for me, as I acknowledge in the article. I mean, that's essentially – there's no way around that. On the other hand, as his general counsel said, you know, they need to do a better job of showing the world that Steve Cohen is not this reclusive billionaire with long stringy hair and long fingernails. I think that's true, and if all they want to do is show that he's a successful trader, they've done a good job of that here.
Just one more thing about the art collection. What kinds of paintings or sculptures or whatever does he collect?
He started with Impressionists, as many do, 10 years ago.
And it's always safe.
But he has gotten into contemporary art across the board, everything from the most radical to, you know, I mean, I think what was the last thing? He got one of the Jasper Johns flags for $110 million,
yeah,
I think.
That's not radical anymore. That's the 1960s.
That's right. But he has
50s.
He has de Kooning. I'm sure he has the drip paintings. He has the things you're supposed to have, but he also has Francis Bacon.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm not impressed. I'd like him going out there buying work by people who are working right now and who you take a chance on, just like you do when you play a game of poker.
I think he does some of that, but I'm sure that the $110 million Jasper Johns is somehow closer to his heart.
Yeah, I'd like to have one myself. Brian Burrow is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair. His latest article is What's Eating Steve Cohen? It's in the July issue of the magazine. Thank you so much for being with us again. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure.